Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge struck down changes passed during Wisconsin's lame duck legislative session that would have restricted early voting in the state. We'll get the latest with our state capitol reporter.
First, increasing funds for K-12 education in the state was a priority for Governor Tony Evers' campaign. Now, a bipartisan task force has wrapped up a year's worth of work around the state and agrees more funding is needed.
The Blue Ribbon Commission on School Funding won't be putting forth standalone bills, but its recommendations include more money for special education in schools with low-income students and letting tax revenue limits for school districts rise with inflation.
Luther Olson is a Republican state senator from Ripon, representing Wisconsin's 14th Senate District. He co-chaired the Blue Ribbon Commission. Senator Olson, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, as you and your fellow members of the Blue Ribbon Commission went around the state, what kind of problems were you hearing raised by people in different communities?
Well, it's interesting because as we went around and heard from folks from, you know, all over the state, from way up north to way down south, and all corners and central Wisconsin, we heard sort of the same message, one that they really would like us to have give them some certainty on what kind of revenue limits they would can look for every year. And they really suggested, you know, just let us have CPI so that we can know what's going to happen. Right now, they just know 1 year for sure, and the next year they have no idea, and it's pretty hard to budget.
And CPI means that the revenue limits would go up along with inflation rates, right?
Correct, right, which just keeps them equal. And so that was one of the big things they talked about. Talked about dealing with special ed funding because that need has gone up, but our amount has stayed the same, and so they have been taking money out of Fund 10, which is for regular education, to supplement what they spend on special ed. A number of school districts are dealing with declining enrollments, and the way that the system works is that we say if you lose kids, it costs you the same amount per kid or student as it did when you had, you know, 10 more, but in essence it really costs you more per student because your fixed costs are pretty big.
You can't turn the heat off in a school, for example, per kid.
Yeah, or, you know, you lose one or two kids in a classroom, you can't get rid of a teacher. So the costs continue to, you know, go up per student. And so we have to recognize that. We're having more students coming to school that are bilingual, bicultural, so it costs more to educate them. They would like us to recognize that. We have more kids coming to school with poverty, and that's another issue, and they'd like us to recognize that. So there was a number of things that they brought forth, and the committee listened, and we put those forth in their report.
Now, school funding in Wisconsin, I would say, has got to be among the most complicated pieces of our state budget. Are you looking to take the whole thing apart and start from scratch or change some things around the margin here?
Around the margin, because we can make it simple, but that will be not fair to districts because we have districts that have different levels of property value per child. We have some that, you know, have get aided at the rate of like over 80%, and some get aided at zero. And so our formula does work. The problem is the revenue limits and what we do with increasing and decreasing enrollments, which really causes people some problems.
So let's get into some of the specific recommendations now. You mentioned allowing those revenue limits to go up along with inflation, which means, in effect, they don't go up. They stay the same in inflation-adjusted dollars. Another thing you mentioned was special education. What kind of changes in special education funding are you proposing?
Well, really, we're looking at increasing the percentage of reimbursement because the way the system works now is you have cost. First of all, special ed students have IEPs, individual education programs, and so they have to have services on what this program says, and so schools have to put that first. And so we have over time, because we haven't increased the amount, the percentage of what we reimburse has gone down. So it wouldn't be changing the formula, it just would be increasing the percentage to get it back where we were, you know, a few years ago.
Talking to State Senator Luther Olson about recommendations for education funding in Wisconsin. Another issue you tackle in your recommendations is mental health care for students. What kind of things are you hoping to fund and see in actual schools?
Well, we have more mental health issues than we've had in ever, I believe. And so schools are having issues getting staff, working together with the community, and there is not enough money to help students who have mental health issues. Now, that's different than special ed. This is people who just have mental health issues that need to be dealt with, and so we have in the past, and I think we will in the future, given schools more funds to deal with that, because if a student is not mentally healthy, they're not going to learn, and so this has become a bigger problem in our state and all over the country.
You also mentioned bilingual education, students coming from different language backgrounds. You've got kind of a simple math tweak when it comes to funding for those students. What would happen?
Well, we just say that they would count at 1.2 students, because we heard from superintendents and principals and teachers that, you know, we have these kids that come to their schools that really don't speak any English, and so they have to have staff to help them learn English and learn the subject material at the same time. And I know we heard from Green Bay, I can't remember how many different languages those kids now have when they come to their schools, and so it has become a bigger issue for a lot of schools than it ever was before, because we have more folks from other countries coming to Wisconsin, families coming to work and sending their kids to school. And a lot of these kids do very, very well, but it's a challenge to get them to learn English and be productive students.
I want to talk about the overall challenge here, because there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach, right? You've got rural school districts with declining enrollment facing those challenges. You might have Milwaukee, a school in a neighborhood with a high concentration of poverty. It's got its own unique challenges. There might be a high poverty rural county as well. How difficult does that variety of districts in Wisconsin make it to try to craft a plan like this?
Well, that's why we came up with individual ideas, because, you know, just saying, okay, here, every school district needs this or that, we decided not to do that. And there's some things that are in common across the state, dealing with special ed or dealing with, you know, being able to figure out what your budget's going to be in the future. Some deal with declining enrollments, as you said. Some deal with helping schools that are sparsely populated or that need to figure out, can we consolidate with our neighbors? We have a proposal in there that said you could start a K-8 district or K-6 district if you wanted to. And so then, let's say you have a couple districts wanting to go together, but they don't want to send their little kiddos, you know, away on a bus. So we said as well, you could start your school district like we have now, K-8 district, keep them in town and send the high school kids to a high school district like we have some of those in the state of Wisconsin. We're not forcing anybody to do this, but it gives them an option.
Let's talk about funding now. A little bit here, a little bit there. It starts to add up. Are you looking for these things to be paid for in part by raising local property taxes or ending the limits there? Or is this coming from the state general revenue fund? Where is the money coming from?
Well, that'll be up to the Joint Finance Committee and the legislature and the governor. The governor was in the other day, and he said he did not want to raise property taxes, which means then it comes from the general revenue fund.
So you've got all these ways to tinker with our school funding. It goes to Governor Evers now, maybe to include in his budget. Does this have a chance? Do these recommendations have a chance of becoming law?
Well, I mean, Governor Evers said he wants to spend $1.4 billion more on K-12 education. I'm not sure where the legislature is, but I'm hoping that this can be a landing spot for the governor and the legislature. And really what we did is we said, okay, if you're going to spend money, here is where it needs to be spent, because this is what the folks around the state said are the big areas that need to be addressed.
Senator Olson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Luther Olson is a state senator representing Wisconsin's 14th Senate District. He co-chaired the bipartisan Blue Ribbon Commission on School Funding. He talked with us about the group's recommendations heading into the next budget cycle.
Changes made to Wisconsin's voting laws during December's lame duck legislative session were struck down by a federal judge yesterday.
The changes included a shorter time period to vote early for Wisconsin residents and tightened restrictions on student IDs at the polls. Almost immediately after those changes were approved, legal challenges were filed in the courts.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Laurel, you've been covering this issue for quite a while, so take us back a little bit. What were some of the changes that were approved last month?
So a couple of the changes that were approved have to do with, as you guys mentioned, the IDs that you can use for voting. But the really big one that a lot of people focused on was this restriction on early voting in Wisconsin. So essentially what that would have done is restrict early voting to the 14 days before Election Day. Now, the big deal here is that some communities in Wisconsin since 2016 have offered several weeks of early voting, sometimes longer than a month, communities like Madison and Milwaukee. So limiting that to 14 days would certainly limit those communities in the amount of early voting they were able to offer some folks. So that really concerned the plaintiffs in a lawsuit that had been filed a few years ago, and they went back to the judge in that case to see if this new law violated his judgment from previously, to see if they could get that law struck down.
Now, how were these changes first received by lawmakers when they were first introduced?
So they did bring up a lot of those points, you know, the concern about limiting places like Madison and Milwaukee, where decisions have been made by election officials to offer longer time periods for early voting, so people can come in at their convenience, cast ballots in person, or, you know, mail them back. For a variety of reasons, clerks decided to do that. Now, people that supported the restriction to 14 days said it's not really fair that communities in Wisconsin can offer such an extensive amount of time for early voting when other parts of the state, particularly communities in rural parts of the state, don't have the resources to do that. They don't have the funds, they don't have the staffing to have that much time available. So they said that they really wanted to level the playing field and make sure early voting was equal across the state. But then that kind of spurred the argument of, well, just because some people can't do it doesn't mean we shouldn't offer it to communities that need it. So that was kind of the political back and forth before these laws were passed during the lame duck.
Now, did that have anything to do, when we talk about places like Madison, Milwaukee, compared to more rural areas, did that have to do with population more than anything else is in terms of why some communities are able to offer an extended early voting period while others can't?
Mm-hmm. Population was a big part of the argument. So Democratic lawmakers that opposed this plan said there are more people that need to vote in a community like Milwaukee, for example. So offering a longer amount of time for all those folks to get in, cast their ballot early so they don't necessarily have to come in on Election Day and stand in a long line, that's particularly helpful for those very population-dense areas.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, and we're talking about the changes made to Wisconsin's voting laws during December's lame duck legislative session, which were struck down by a federal judge yesterday. Now, speaking of which, there were legal challenges immediately after these changes were first signed by Governor Scott Walker. Which groups brought on the lawsuits and why?
So the groups that were involved in this lawsuit was One Wisconsin Institute, which is a group that has been involved in legal challenges to state election laws for years. But they had some new allies this time. The redistricting organization that's run by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. signed on to help them with this, which was kind of an interesting development. A very obviously high-profile national figure there signing on. And then another Wisconsin group, Citizen Action, was involved with this as well.
What arguments did they make when they challenged the lame duck changes?
So this is a part where it gets a little bit wonky and complicated. So as I mentioned, one Wisconsin institute filed this lawsuit before about election laws in Wisconsin. They filed that, I believe, in 2015. Now, a variety of laws were challenged in that lawsuit. A judge came out and ruled in 2016, and he struck down a number of election laws in Wisconsin, including a restriction on early voting that was 10 days, limiting early voting to 10 days. So with that 2016 decision in the back of their pocket, this organization said, "We believe these new lame duck laws violate this previous decision." So they went back to that judge and said, "This isn't a new lawsuit. This is just additional information for the lawsuit that we've previously brought. We believe that these new laws are in violation of your 2016 ruling. Would you issue an injunction to keep these laws from being enforced because they violate your previous ruling?" So they filed that very shortly after the laws were signed by Governor Walker in mid-December. And of course, we just got that decision yesterday from the judge saying, "Yes, indeed, I do believe that these violate my 2016 ruling."
And this was Judge James Peterson of the Western District of Wisconsin who mm-hmm. struck down these amendments to the law, and he had done that in the past. Mm-hmm. And as you said, he's just basically ruled the same way.
Right. He just said these new laws may be new laws. They have new numbers and slightly different parameters. Instead of a 10-day limit on early voting, it's a 14-day limit on early voting. But they still limit early voting. And I said that wasn't an okay thing to do. So these laws can't stand.
Now, you spoke with Annalise Eicher about the judge's decision. She's the program director for One Wisconsin Now, one of the groups that challenged these changes. Here's what she had to say.
Having them tossed out and the judge, you know, agreeing with us yet again that these unconstitutional attacks were just that, unconstitutional, is really great.
Now, how are these changes unconstitutional?
So essentially, it's the judge ruled in 2016 that they place unnecessary barriers for certain individuals to vote. So part of the argument that the plaintiffs made in the case that was decided in 2016 was that early voting restrictions place an unnecessary burden on certain populations, including minorities, the elderly, and students, because those are generally the individuals that utilize early voting for a variety of reasons and kind of need that flexibility. So the judge ruled that those restrictions are in violation of those individuals' rights to vote.
Now, I know this is just one legal fight over the issue, mm-hmm. Probably one of many. Where does this stand in other courts?
So this is, of course, incredibly complicated, as many lawsuits are. So after the 2016 ruling, the decision was appealed to a higher court. We are still awaiting a decision by that court. It's the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Milwaukee. So the case is sitting there right now, as are this new motion for an injunction that Judge Peterson granted yesterday. So that's kind of all wrapped up in with this now. So we are going to get another decision on this case at some point in the future. When that decision comes down, then there is the option, obviously, for it to be appealed again to another high court. So the debate over election laws in Wisconsin and the litigation over election laws in Wisconsin isn't something that's going away anytime in the near future.
Have you heard from any other groups that are going to be appealing the judge's decision?
Well, we know that the defendants in this case have already appealed it. So we know that it's already sitting there. That's already on the docket for the future of this case. And we would imagine, you know, whoever comes out on the losing side in this next decision is certain to appeal it. That's just kind of how these processes tend to work. So this case will be sticking around for a while, as we've seen a number of other voting lawsuits in Wisconsin.
Laurel, it seems to be that every few years there is this discussion or this issue always comes up. Do you ever foresee a time where there could be some type of compromise between both parties in terms of early voting or making it as simple and as easy for people to vote as possible?
It's an interesting debate in the state capitol for sure. I think there's such a fundamental difference between where the parties have stood up until this point. I think we really got a fresh look at that during the lame duck session to see kind of how differently the two parties come down on this argument, with Republicans arguing primarily that there should be kind of this uniformity across the state of Wisconsin to make sure that it's fair for everybody, and Democrats arguing that different communities should be able to do what works for them. And if that means that there isn't absolute equality from a community to community based on, you know, timing or things like that, number of locations for voting, et cetera, that should be okay. So it seems like there's a pretty big rift there in terms of how the two parties think early voting should be done in Wisconsin. As far as predicting what sort of compromise could be made in the future, I definitely couldn't go out on a limb and and guess. If I knew that, gosh, that would be valuable, but I don't.
with about 30 seconds left, what does that mean for this year's state Supreme Court election?
Well, people are definitely keeping their eyes on the state Supreme Court election. That election is going to be in April. And the balance of the court isn't up in this particular election. It's Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who's aligned with liberals on the court generally, that's her seat is being up for election. So if a liberal wins, the balance stays the same. If a conservative wins, it tilts a little bit. So obviously something to keep an eye on as lawsuits move forward.
Thank you so much, Laura. We appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laura White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joins us to talk about a federal judge's decision yesterday to strike down changes to Wisconsin's voting laws that were passed during last month's lame duck session.
Life is full of exciting moments and life challenges alike. The arrival of a new baby, a move to a new home, the loss of a loved one.
During these times, it can be hard to get the basics done, like laundry or making dinner. And our Food Friday guest says one of the best ways to connect to people is to help feed them during these key moments in their lives.
Janet Rich Elsbach writes the blog A Raisin and a Porpoise. Her new book is called Extra Helping: Recipes for Caring, Connecting, and Building Community One Dish at a Time. Janet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, what led you into this idea of combining traditional cookbook recipes with this idea of, hey, this is a way to reach out to friends, neighbors, family, and more?
Well, it was kind of two factors. One, it was such a resource and such a help to me and my family during times that have been pretty difficult in recent years. So I was just well aware of the power of it. And one of the things you have to do when you have a book idea is find comparable titles that exist in the world. And I really couldn't find very much that just approached food from this idea of building community and being helpful to other people. And, you know, there's plenty of the special diet for people with this, that, or the other thing, or, you know, any number of resources for that, those sort of niche purposes. But this is, I wanted to come at it more from the idea of how do you just develop a way of showing up helpfully, regardless, really, of the circumstance or anyone's special particular needs.
You know, Janet, you have said that that delivery of food during particularly stressful, emotional times can feel really good. Why is food a great way to show up for people?
Again, a couple of reasons. One, I think it's one of the very few universals. If you get through a difficult time, or if you get through a difficult Tuesday, you know, from beginning to end, you probably ate something. People need to eat pretty frequently, and so it's just it's a fairly universal need, and it's also it's a pretty simple act of care. It's something we all tend to do in one way or another for ourselves, whether we cook or not. If you don't cook, you certainly know how to access food in some other way, again, because it's a sort of universal need. And people's thresholds for attention, conversation, other kinds of assistance are sort of all over the map, but people's need for food is pretty universal. So it's something that you can show up and offer if someone's not in the mood to interact just by leaving it on their doormat. So it's just a very plug-and-play, sort of universal way to access supporting somebody, because you know they need it, you know they need food.
And one thing I love, Janet, is that you talk about when you're cooking for somebody else, remember that you're cooking for them and what they want and what they need, not what you necessarily think they should have. Can you talk about that?
Sure. When I reflect on it, I think, you know, people ask me sort of what's the one thing that everybody needs to know, and I kind of came at this from a place of the recipes, which I believe in and I spend a lot of time developing, are secondary to just that willingness and curiosity. I think those are the two things that you kind of need to have. The curiosity about what is somebody hungry for, what do they really detest, what are they missing most if they're going through an illness. Sometimes certain things are off limits, and how could you offer them something that's satisfying, that satisfies that same hunger that maybe conforms to what they're able to eat. And I feel like curiosity is a real, it's one essential item in the toolkit. It's, like you said, that you don't come in saying, this is what makes me feel better, and so obviously it's going to make you feel better. If you come in and ask, you can learn so much about that person. You can deepen the connection in really meaningful ways. And you also, with all of these things, you develop your skill set and your toolkit so that when you go into the next situation, you have a lot more information to offer the next person.
So, Janet, let's say you wanted to take food to someone. You know, how do you account for things like food allergies and dislikes?
That's a great question. I think those are more and more a factor both in people's diets and also in what holds people back from showing up in a helpful way now, because you think, oh, I don't know, I think they're one of their kids has a nut allergy, or maybe that one of them is a vegan, I can't remember, and then people just get overwhelmed, as they often do when called upon to help in any situation. People say, I didn't want to intrude, or I wasn't sure what to do, and then people just don't offer anything at all. And I would say, first of all, showing up in this way with a meal, even if worst case scenario it isn't something they can eat, you've still done something pretty nice. You've demonstrated that you were thinking about them for as long as it took you to prepare or procure whatever you've offered them, which is great. And the other thing is that these days it's a lot easier in situations where people are going through something pretty rigorous in terms of trouble, like an illness or a loss, or even something great like having a baby. There's all these technological things now, apps and websites that help you keep track of what they can and can't eat. And the other thing that's great about most of those sites is you can see what other people are bringing them, so you don't bring them the seventh lasagna of the week. You can look and go, oh, I think they might be a little tired of pasta. You know, I'll try something else. And I think those tools, one of the great things about those tools is it's sort of hard to say to someone who says, I'm going to make you dinner. What can you guys not eat? People tend to be a little hesitant, saying, well, you know, the youngest doesn't like mushrooms, and, you know, running down the list of things. But they're much more comfortable just entering preferences into a device. So I'm a big believer in those kinds of technology assists.
Janet Rich Elsbach is with us. Her new book is called Extra Helping: Recipes for Caring, Connecting, and Building Community One Dish at a Time. Janet, in your recipes, you tackle some challenges that don't always come up in your basic cookbooks. One of them is transportability. As you learned one time when you had a good layer of soup, I think, on the floor of your car, what kind of things can we think about to make sure our food is easily transportable, to drop off at the person's house or to bring to the big community event?
Well, that is definitely, that deepens the learning curve when you have to scrape minestrone out of your floor mats. I am a huge believer in mason jars, just because they're sturdy, they're very inexpensive to acquire. People are often just getting rid of them on Craigslist or, you know, some other at a tag sale, or just cleaning out their basement, and they have secure lids, which is just the holy grail of food transport, something that you can really tighten the lid down on. And they come in a bazillion sizes. They're heat-proof. That's just a great resource. One of the things I remember when we were given food, particularly after having babies, was the task of remembering whose dishes were whose and sort of keeping track of that was just another thing to think about. And the nice thing about inexpensive things like mason jars is they're reusable, recyclable, you know, have sort of an endless lifespan, and they're, again, pretty inexpensive to acquire, so you don't need to track too preciously, like, who did this come from? But so a big believer in mason jars and a big believer in a lot of things that you can pick up at tag sales and yard sales and places like that, you know, that have, basically anything with a good lid that clamps right down.
One of the things that I've noticed that you've done in the book is that you've split it up based on the type of life event a person's experiencing. So why'd you do that?
Well, that kind of gets back to what we were talking about curiosity and how the mindset that you approach things with is really more important than what you're cooking. I try to think about what each kind of situation demands of a person going through it, and then I put in recipes that suggested themselves to me as things that would be comforting or supportive or entertaining or rewarding for any of those situations. And I did that in conversation with a lot of people. I asked a lot of people, like, what are things that you remember someone showing up with for you, or that were really comforting to you as a kid? And it was very revealing to hear from all these people about what those things were. And it touches on one of the nice parts for me about being curious and asking those questions, and also looking kind of beyond my cultural background or ethnic background to what other people were fed and find appealing. Again, food is just really universal. Being fed by whoever took care of you when you were little, being comforted by it, is such a powerful thing. You never forget that. And it deepens your, because you've had that experience, whether for you it was chicken noodle soup and for this other person it was, you know, roasted who knows what. The feeling is a place where empathy can grow from, or compassion and just mutual understanding can grow from that, because everybody's had that feeling of being handed just the right thing at a particular time, whatever form it took. So I just tried to think about those situations in general and walk readers through my thinking process, so that not so they could necessarily make the 7 or 8 or 9 recipes in that chapter for their people, but so they could go, oh, you know, actually this person, I think this would be more suitable, or maybe I'll see if they like this thing that my grandmother used to make for me. Or it's more the thought process and the curiosity that you approach it with.
We're talking with author Janet Rich Elsbach about how we can show we care and build community through cooking during this edition of Food Friday.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to dish when you are taking something to a neighbor or a loved one when they can use a helping hand? How has your community maybe supported you with food and offers of help during good or bad times in your life when you needed a little help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Janet Rich Elsbach, author of Extra Helping, Recipes for Caring, Connecting, and Building Community One Dish at a Time.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever done this? Somebody has a new kid, has a death in the family, a big life event. You bring some food over for them. Do you have a go-to dish that you like to bring people in that situation? Or have you ever had that moment where you were on the receiving end of people bringing you food? How much did it help? What were some of your favorite things about that? Or do you have a question for our guest about something maybe you can bring to somebody this weekend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, head over to WPR.org/Food Friday. We have a few recipes from Janet there. And Janet, let's get into one of those now. You shared little recipes for twice-baked potatoes. Now, why is this a good one to bring over for other people to reheat at will?
Well, that's a great one, both in terms of how wonderful it is to offer other people, and also one of the common questions I get is, I'm so busy, there's no way I can barely feed myself or my family, I can't fit cooking for other people into this picture. And to me, those potatoes are basically the self-care option, because it's a recipe that you can do in bits and pieces. You have the oven on for some other reason, you can bake the potatoes and then you can put them away until you have time to deal with the rest of it, and you can do it stepwise in that way, And then what you end up with is something that's so versatile. Someone can, you know, grab it off the counter and on their way to the changing table with the baby or on their way to orchestra practice or whatever, and they reheat really well. They travel really well. So it's just a great, and it's such a basic thing. I mean, it's cutting an X in a potato, baking till it's cooked, and then mixing some stuff inside. And it gets back to what we were talking about before about adapting things to your people. It works with anything. It works for vegans, and it works for carnivores, and it works for all kinds of people because it's just such an adaptable idea. You're basically baking a potato and then singing it up, as a friend of mine used to say.
You know, you've also shared a recipe for aguadito. What exactly is aguadito?
Aguadito is a Peruvian chicken soup, and it's, ooh, you know, chicken soup is a pretty standard measure of,
yes, that's pretty universal.
Yeah, taking care of people. But the interesting thing about it is when you travel around the globe, it takes it a little bit different form in various places, and the form that it takes there is this kind of richly seasoned, not rich in the heavy sense, but just very flavorful, very seasoned soup, which again is really adaptable to individual tastes. It has a little bit of kick, a little bit of spice, which you can dial up or dial down depending on who you're feeding. And it's just a little bit outside the ordinary chicken soup, which there's absolutely nothing wrong with. It's kind of the gold standard of taking care of people, but it's just a way to add a little something else to your repertoire if chicken soup is your kind of comfort food.
And Janet, you gave another piece of practical advice that I love. Sometimes when people have brought food over, you look at it and think, how long do I heat it up? What temperature? Stovetop, oven, what? You suggest having those materials handy for labeling.
Labeling goes, to me, along with the mason jar, I don't ever run out of masking tape and a Sharpie, because you can just label containers with your name and you can label them with really basic instructions, because especially when people are overwhelmed by a difficult circumstance, they're not, whatever you tell them verbally, they're very unlikely to remember an hour or 2 hours later the next day when they go to make use of the food. So it's great to just write on the container and something that you can remove. This, put this in the oven at 350, take the cover off, the dressing's in the jar, this is the dressing for the salad, that kind of thing is really helpful. And I also love, while we're talking about particular instructions, I love putting a note in. And all of these things are just really basic. They're not, you don't need to have gone to chef school or been doing this for years or anything. Just, you know, even clipping a little comic out of the paper or writing a quick note thinking of you or sharing some little thing on the note. I keep a lot of those notes, I think I said in the book, and not because they tell me how to reheat the potatoes, but the sentiments that people shared when they delivered food were so meaningful and really moving. So you have a lot of opportunity on that index card or, you know, the back of the grocery list to write just a little something.
Let's go to a call. Let's go to Kim in Eau Claire. Good afternoon, Kim. Welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you. Yes, my wife and I are retired, and just yesterday I made chili, and the neighbors have two children, and they have a busy schedule after school. So even then I brought the chili over, but throughout the summer we'll do that when they've got so many things going, like people do nowadays with the kids, ball, dance, blah, blah. So we make them dinners. They call when they're coming home. We have it hot and bring it over so they have food.
Kim,
that's so great. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Kim. What about chili? I imagine like chicken soup, chili can be universal too, depending on how you make it.
Exactly, depending on how you make it. And you need, you know, knowing a little bit about who you're serving it to. But the thing that struck me most about that call was the enjoyment in his voice about showing up for people in that way. It really is a two-way street. It's people sometimes feel uncomfortable taking help because they think they're a burden or they think they're, you know, it sort of makes the scale uneven in some way. But when someone's going through something, and again, it can be as minor as a Tuesday when the kids have team practice or, you know, a pretty significant life event, when you want to be of use and of, you know, of some help, it's very gratifying. It's definitely an exchange, and it makes it, to me, it's a spiral that moves through a community, because if you've offered that help and the person's accepted it, then maybe down the line when you are strapped in some way, you'll be more ready to accept it, and they'll be more ready to offer it. And it really strengthens a community. One of the criticisms I read of the book, somebody said, well, this is a fantasy book. Who lives in a place where there's people who show up with food for you? And I thought, that's so great. What you're saying is you're the person who needs to start it where you are. Show up for your neighbor. You know, offer them, do just as that caller did. Make extra. You have extra soup, and just bring them some. And then it's not a fantasy anymore. You've started creating exactly that network of support that is great to participate in, both as a giver and a receiver.
Kim, thanks for sharing that story. We're talking to Janet Rich-Elsbach. Her new book is called Extra Helping, Recipes for Caring, Connecting, and Building Community One Dish at a Time. I want to get into another section of your book, Janet. A lot of this has been, you know, the family next door or the friends across town or whatever. You also talk and have a chapter about cooking for that big group, whether it's a preschool class you did or the team or the volunteers at the library or whatever. Talk about your strategies for cooking for that larger community.
That's where willingness really plays a big part, because the first time, I think the story I told in the book was this one of the moms at school who has four kids and runs her own business and is incredibly fit and just one of the, you know, a very daunting presence to say no to because she fits so much into her own life, asked if I would, as she asked every mother or father at the school, would you make soup for the faculty on Thursdays? And I wanted to say, I've never made that much of anything. You know, it was for 40 or 50 people. But you couldn't say no to this person. So I thought, well, I guess I'll figure it out. And that was, of course, when the soup ended up in my floor mat, so I learned a very powerful lesson about jars with lids. But just willingness and willingness to experiment a little bit, willingness to rely, maybe if you're a scratch cook, willingness to rely on canned beans in that situation because it allows you to fit the cooking into whatever time you have available. I'm a big believer in fitting it in however it fits in your life. You don't need to do it the way that somebody else does it. It's great if you can do it. If showing up for dinner for someone involves swinging by the store and picking something up for them, you've started. That's great. And maybe the next time you would cook something yourself. But if that's the only way you can do it, it's offering the help is great. And cooking for huge numbers of people, it draws on a lot of the same skills as cooking for a small number of people. There's a little more math involved, but it's just something you need to start, and you learn some lessons along the way by washing out the floor mats, and then you go forward and you try it again.
With about a minute left, if you're not a cooker or a baker, but you still want to support someone, what resources are available to help you help people through food?
Well, again, in this day and age, it is, you know, the work of a minute Googling to find a meal delivery service. Especially if someone, even if you are a cook, but the person you want to help is, you know, miles and miles away, you can often order something and have it delivered to them. There's, you know, anything from full meal kits to you can have a restaurant, you know, bring them dinner. But I really encourage people to find, someone said to me, I can't show up for people like this. The only thing I know how to do is make apple pie or whatever it was in her case. And I thought, well, that's great. You don't need a whole repertoire of things. You're the person who shows up with a pie. You know, you can start with something really basic, like baking a potato and scraping it out and baking it again. And then all of a sudden you've done something really that's gratifying to you and to the person who's going to receive it. So just find one little place to start. And you only need to be capable of doing one thing. And then you can say, this is my thing.
Really inspiring, Janet. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Janet Rich-Elsbach blogs at A Raisin and a Porpoise and is the author of the book we've been talking about, Extra Helping, Recipes for Caring, Connecting, and Building Community One Dish at a Time.
You can find those recipes at WPR.org, Food Friday, and you can share stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday, we asked you what technologies you grew up with that other generations wouldn't understand.
We heard from a few more of you after the conversation was over and emailed about younger generations. Would they understand a drive-in movie? We were just kidding the other day that kids today would park in a field and pull out a tablet to watch a movie. On Twitter, we heard about card catalogs, floppy disks, and the rewind button on Walkmans and tape players and so forth. And Jarrell, you had a couple others after the show you were talking about that were great.
Yeah, here's a couple. Remember the TV guide before VHS? If you missed your show, you had to wait for the repeat, and you never knew when that was going to be. Meeting your family and friends at the airport gate.
At the gate?
Yes, the gate.
I remember
all the
that.
Way at the gate.
You can't do that anymore.
The floppy disk we talked about. How about this one? Remember when TV used to go off? Remember the colored bars? You get the national anthem, and then you get the right afterward. Yeah, you get the colored bars
on
bars.
That.
Yeah, you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, maybe. I bet somebody's got those on YouTube. They pull it off of videotape. We should just watch those. You know, maybe that's what we need to help us fall asleep at night or something. Take us back to the old days.
How about this one?
Yeah.
Look up movie times in the newspaper.
Oh, yeah. And actually, for a while after that stopped, I kept trying to do it. I'm like, no, you don't. You got to go online.
I know. You got to go online. Everybody has apps now. You just go use your Flixster app and just look up movie times.
Well, whatever app you're using, thanks for listening to Central Time. There's more coming up on the Ideas Network.